Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The Trump administration has launched an all-out war on independent science, environmental safeguards, and facts. Leading this attack on science are industry insiders who now occupy positions of power at the EPA, Department of Energy, and other critical federal agencies. In response to these assaults on verifiable science, scientists will be marching on Washington, D.C. this Earth Day, April 22nd, in the first of a week of science actions at the nation's capital, culminating in the People's Climate March on April 29th. This morning, we talked with Colin O'Mara, President and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation, about how scientists are leading a steady, aggressive resistance against the flat Earth world of Donald Trump. Colin, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me on today.
Well, I was thinking the last time we talked was right after the travel ban was instituted, and we were supposed to be talking about ethanol mandates, and we spent a lot of time talking about politics instead. So I thought I'd bring you back, and we'll just talk about the politics of science today. So how does that sound?
Sounds great.
About 3 years ago, I was spending a lot of time in Canada interviewing people about the tar sands and the Trans Mountain Pipeline that is still being proposed to run from the tar sands in Alberta to Burnaby, British Columbia. And I kept hearing the word war on science. And at that time, all kinds of amazing turnarounds in the progressive move of Canadian science were happening under that current very conservative government that rolled back just about everything positive and realistic about climate change and environmental regulations and a lot of other political issues, and really put a clamp on the ability of scientists not just to be able to speak to the public and to the press and to each other, but even to do research. At the time, I was basking in the glow of living in Obama America and thinking what a horrible place Canada's turned into. So now the tables are turned, and as a scientist, I'm wondering, are you looking north to Canada to see like what kind of lessons you can learn about how to deal with the kinds of repressive measures that governments can take on scientific freedom?
It's an interesting question. You know, we haven't actually been talking to the folks that were kind of struggling under the previous kind of Canadian regime. Obviously, the Trudeau's leadership globally on a lot of these conservation issues has been just exemplary since the day he took office. I mean, I think for me the bigger question is, how do we actually make this not a partisan issue at all around science? But we can talk about the science, environmental science and natural resource, you know, kind of based sciences a lot. But I mean, this isn't just stepping away from the natural sciences. I mean, we're seeing, you know, record proposed cuts for things like pretty much any science that's not related directly to defense spending. And I think if you look at the last century, I mean, I would argue that, you know, kind of what made America kind of the last century, I mean, the American century, was our kind of commitment to sound science and how that was the basis of the space program, of, you know, all the telecommunications boom, the impacts we had on improving public health and natural resource health and kind of getting as big. I mean, science was the linchpin of all of those big accomplishments, and it needs to be the foundation for kind of rational decision making, because without it, frankly, because of folks, you know, really speaking nonsense, right? I mean, it's not based in reality, and I think that's what we're trying to, you know, kind of put this conversation back on the fact. It's the old Daniel Patrick Moynihan quote, right? Everyone's entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts. If you're eroding foundational science and questioning sound science, you don't even have that factual basis to have a meaningful policy conversation.
Well, I see two issues, and one is just refuting a lot. Well, we can talk a little bit about Scott Pruitt's infamous statement Friday about climate change. We really don't know how it's being caused and what carbon dioxide has to do with it. But there's that part of it. And then the other part of it is the actual impact that this is going to have between funding cuts and also just disappearing information. And how do we balance those two things as we're trying to, how do we actually get back to the place where we can say that there is scientific evidence, there is such a thing as scientific facts, and yes, science is always constantly changing, as the right-wingers like to tell us, but it doesn't mean that a lot of discoveries aren't still based in facts and still things that we can rely on as we move forward and make decisions.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, I do think that for folks that are dependent on federal data, securing that data as quickly as possible is important. Because as we've seen during other periods, too, this isn't completely unique to this current time period. You know, we do see kind of data sets become more difficult to obtain, less public, less things available through traditional public sources. But I do think that there's a big role for the academic community and also businesses that are increasingly investing in their scientific capacity because they see market opportunities and they're trying to understand the world in which they operate, to really kind of speak out and make sure that science and kind of basic analytic thought is still has a big part in the public discourse, and then use that as a way to hopefully fight against some of the language that we're seeing being thrown around in Washington on the politics, which just unfortunately is the exception globally. It just happens to be our reality here.
Well, it's interesting. When I first heard about the Scientists March on Washington that's scheduled for Earth Day, and there seemed to be some split within the scientific community and definitely in the pundit community about whether it's appropriate for scientists to march. So I'm wondering, what's your take on that? Are you going to be marching on April 22nd? And do you think that this is an appropriate way for scientists to behave?
Yeah, I mean, I always think that it's good to get folks involved. I mean, I think we've become a little too passive as a society on a lot of issues, and I think that's reflected in voter turnout issues and other challenges that we have when folks that have strong opinions don't engage in their kind of democratic responsibilities. I do want to make sure that science is not kind of politicized over kind of too much as it being seen as Republican or Democrat. And so I do think that tone matters, that, kind of facts are facts, and that, it's seen as a support. It's not seen as a hyper-partisan rally, but rather as a rally for that, basically to just send a signal, we need to be guided by science. We need our decision-making to be developed in that way. And I think if that's the message, then that's one thing. There's specific actions. I mean, this Thursday, we're going to see a budget proposed. It's going to have dramatic reductions in the Office of Science and Technology policy. It's going to have massive cuts in the science budgets of EPA and NOAA, the Ocean Atmospheric Administration. It's going to have big cuts to the science programs in the Department of Energy. And so I think the more that it's actionable about, kind of restoring kind of the importance of science, making sure that we're funding kind of critical research, I mean, that's a better, more actionable message than, just being a partisan kind of attack on the administration.
Well, one of the things that is kind of amazing, I'm just thinking back, through my life and sort of the trajectory that science has taken over the last 50 years. And when I was in third grade, there were two big events that happened, and one was that the Soviets launched the first satellite, Sputnik, which shocked America and made us realize that there was, worse than the missile gap was the science gap. And suddenly science education became really important, and it really influenced my education, because from that point on, there was science in every one of my grade school classes, and certainly when I got to junior high school and high school, science was very mandatory. The other thing I remember about that year, it was International Geophysics Year, and there was all these incredible programs, particularly for kids, all about these scientific discoveries that were happening, because there was this big concerted effort over, I think, an 18-month period to really understand the science of the Earth and of space, and it kind of dovetailed very nicely with the space program as well. That was just a nascent space program. Mm-hmm. That seemed to be the trajectory, even through the dark years of George W. Bush, and suddenly it's like just this abyss. And you mentioned that it's really being funding for science is being sacrificed for funding for defense. And there seems to be a big difference between that kind of thinking and the thinking that has led up to it for the last 50 years, where there was an understanding that even for defense, you need to have good science.
That is exactly right. And I think, everyone can remember the old jokes that were told about, Vice President Gore, making the claim about inventing the internet. But what he was talking about was how investments in science, investments in, the ability of government to do foundational work that, frankly, is not often profitable, this upstream scientific work that then can lead to incredible discovery and incredible innovation and commercial applications later, requires that upfront investment. And, DARPA, the Defense Research Program, that, kind of did a lot of the early research that then led to the Internet as it was kind of going through its various iterations, first as a security apparatus and obviously now as the primary way we communicate information around the world, had a huge government component to it. I mean, the amount of the telecommunications industry that came out of NASA is massive. I mean, like, if you every time we have had presidents who have had those kind of moonshots, and obviously President Kennedy is always used as a gold standard with the actual moonshot, but every time you've seen a president kind of put a firm stake in the ground saying, here is a goal, here are the resources, and we're going to have the talent to achieve that, we've never been disappointed. And so, this is why I think I get frustrated, is that there's a disconnect. Because if you look at the biggest challenges facing the globe right now, whether that's climate, whether that's some of the pandemics and cancer and some of the public health challenges, some of the challenges that we're facing around, some of the challenges around security and trying to prevent war and trying to have, you know, kind of a safer, more secure world, whether that's cyber terrorism or physical terrorism and other option, other kind of ways that we're seeing warfare being waged now, as well as building, as well as domestically building a middle class. All four of those absolutely depend on having strong science. And at a time when we're continuing to move down the rankings globally in terms of our scientific literacy of our students, when we're continuing to see, you know, more and more companies abroad doubling down on science and technology development as a way to strengthen their economy, we're cutting funding and we're making it more difficult for some of the most talented folks who want to study at our universities from being able to come to this country, many of whom would stay and create jobs for Americans. And so it's just counterintuitive to the experience he's had over the last century of showing how science is really at the epicenter of doing big things that and really kind of unleashing the potential of the human race. And I think that's the part that's the most heartbreaking. I think that's the message we have to figure out to convey, hopefully a little more concisely than I just did.
Well, we'll work on that. Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Colin O'Mara, who's president and CEO of National Wildlife Federation, and we're talking about the war on science that's being waged by the Trump administration. What do you think are some of the, I know you don't want to stay from away from partisan politics, but I do wonder, what do you think are maybe some of the ideological underpinnings of the Trump administration, and in particular some of his advisors like Steve Bannon, that make them so anti-science? Like, what does it even mean to be anti-science?
Right. I do think that in a lot of cases, science and facts are inconvenient to various worldviews. So, I mean, if you believe that that something like the climate crisis is a crisis that is simply just too expensive to deal with, or that it couldn't possibly be, you know, solved by human ingenuity, by reducing emissions through clean technology and natural, kind of getting back in balance in natural systems, it is much easier to basically attack the science than to kind of have the other alternative, which is basically trying to defend why you think inaction is appropriate. And so I think it's convenient, right? I mean, I think this is the denialism of, you know, smoking causing cancer in the 60s and 70s, right? I mean, we've seen this before. What is different, I think, in this case is that for the most part, those arguments were perpetrated by industries that are specifically at risk because of the science showing the action, the activities that they're engaged in were actually the root cause of these other bigger public health or environmental problems. In this case, you have government kind of increasingly playing that role. And I think that does make it a little different. I mean, of course, in the past, we've had reports that have been scrubbed. We've had findings that have been delayed. But we haven't seen as much of a all-out assault on the underlying science itself, and in some cases, the scientists. We just haven't really seen that to the same extent coming from government. We've seen that coming from industry, and kind of, and there's been courtroom battles and the like. But I do think it's this, you know, inconvenient truth of, you know, some of these scientific findings. It's easier just to kind of try to attack the science or find some small footnote that's wrong or some small anecdote, and then try to use that as a justification for getting, you know, kind of discoloring or discrediting a global consensus.
Well, I was thinking about some of the articles I was reading this morning on my thinking, getting ready for the show. And there was a number of articles that I saw that had to deal with things like the being able to secure data, which seems to be a big thing, and other articles about the defunding. And I wanted to talk, first of all, about all the data, because I heard and read a few weeks ago about all these scientists all around the country that were trying to download as much government data as possible. And I think I had a very naive image of what that was about until I read this article last night, which in the New York Times, that made it sound like this is a really, really hard job to do. So what do you know about the move to try to secure data that's been on government servers for all this time, and in fact this whole centralized compilation of scientific data that we've moved towards since we are in more of a paperless culture than we used to be? And what are the hopes that this actually can be secured?
The amount of data that the federal government does kind of have custodianship of is mind-boggling. I think the average American, I think, would be blown away to learn how much of the data that we depend on. Everything from satellite, you know, stuff coming from satellites to, you know, all the number of things that mean, traffic data, I mean, the number of things that are compiled by some federal agency that are just that all the things that are, when we're using your phone, you're trying to get from point A to point B, when you're trying to, you know, figure out what the weather is going to be the next day. I mean, there are massive amounts of that, kind of those big data sets behind it that are in government custody. Not all of it. Some of it's private, but a lot of it is, or local, but a lot of it is kind of publicly available through those sources. I mean, what we've seen in previous administrations is that all the climate science becomes a little more difficult. You know, some web pages come down. But for the most part, you know, the data was still there. It's just kind of a little hard to get to. I think there's a fear in this case that more data could be just kind of expunged from the record, and then it wouldn't be available. And so, you know, as the New York Times reported, I mean, you have universities and private institutions and nonprofit organizations trying to, you know, kind of bring, you know, kind of make sure they're accumulating as much of this information as possible and downloading massive amounts. But I mean, you're talking, you know, I mean, it's almost hard to fathom how much data you're talking about and the complexity behind it. This isn't just, you know, kind of filling up a couple flash drives and kind of taking it to your office. I mean, you're talking, you know, massive amounts of computing power necessary to have this amount of data. And I think folks are trying to be strategic. Again, and hopefully none of this is necessary. I mean, hopefully this is, you know, a precautionary step that turns out not to be necessary. But I think there is the worry that if that data isn't there, a lot of it's irreplicable, especially a lot of the time series data, things that goes, you know, data sets that go back into the 40s and 50s, when, you know, the big investments were made in a lot of these systems, in that kind of pre and kind of early years of NASA and in the early years of some of like the satellite programs that kind of go into the 60s. If you lose those data sets, it'd almost be impossible to rebuild them. And because we're not in the days of the, you know, kind of the Library of Congress style federal depositories where you just kind of go to the local library and, you know, kind of check out the annals from 1968 to find the data point that you need, a lot of that is virtualized now. And so if you lose access, it'd be almost impossible to recreate. So we're supporting a lot of those efforts, and there's great organizations like the Union of Concerned Scientists and others that are partners of the National Wildlife Federation that are doing a lot of that, and obviously a lot of university provosts are working on this as well with various colleges. So I'm optimistic, but I do think that, you know, time is of the essence.
I also wonder if this doesn't point back to maybe we should have hard copies of things more readily available, and maybe there should be a Library of Congress equivalent for scientific data points.
I think it's worth looking at. I mean, a lot of that was done as a cost saving measure during the 90s, as they were trying to, you know, there's all these great efforts that to try to reduce, you know, paper and kind of expense of various federal programs. And the answer to a lot of things was just digitize everything, because how could we imagine not having access to these things later? But, you know, and again, I mean, I'm hopeful that none of this is necessary, that it's a precaution, you know, without need later. But I just think we have to, you know, it's like the old, you know, President Reagan quote, you know, kind of trust but verify. I mean, we have to verify that we have access to the data, and rather than trust that it's there.
Yeah, actually, I was thinking back to this science fiction story by Stanislaw Lem back in the 70s where every piece of paper on the planet disintegrated. This was before everything was digitized. And I've thought about that often when I'm thinking, I'm much more frightened about every piece of digital data disintegrating than I am about paper at this point. But it does seem like we really have this vulnerability and everything being centralized. And I think that, again, it points to the fact that if there's a difference between, well, it's kind of ironic in a way, because those of us who have basically trusted government, or to some degree for, you know, many years, and believe that the government has a role in things like having centralized storage of very important data across the board, all subjects and all issues. And suddenly here we are. And then there's those people who didn't trust the government, and they're now running the government, and therefore make us who did trust the government not trust what they're going to do. So it does seem like it makes us really think about, well, how do you store this kind of information in a way that will be really truly accessible to everybody who needs it?
Well, and there's a historical precedent for this, and not to go too far in my liberal arts education, but, you know, I mean, think about like when we had, you know, kind of dark periods and the slowest periods of intellectual development in kind of Western civilization, right? So after the Library of Alexandria goes down, after the Roman Empire, you know, kind of collapses, you know, those pockets of knowledge kind of dry up, right? And you have these, you know, kind of the dark ages, right? You have these periods where, you know, into the medieval period where you just don't have as much learning and not as much advancement, because you don't have kind of the proliferation of research and literature available, you know, until the Irish, you know, kind of have some of the repositories that are kind of uncovered in that period. The Renaissance obviously brings back a lot of materials. But, I mean, we've had these periods where when society is deprived of kind of high levels of, you know, kind of the best research from the best minds, we don't do that well as a species. So, and I think this is where, you know, I'm so focused on the challenge that the timing couldn't be worse, right? Because we're going to be fighting these fights, expending our energy over whether science is important, whether we should have access to certain kinds of information, instead of focusing on, you know, the 8,000 to 12,000 wildlife species across the country that are at risk of going extinct in the next half century, at a time when we should be focused on reducing emissions and moving towards a clean energy economy, at a time when we should be focused on making sure that we're getting, you know, kids outdoors and introducing them to science and technology education so they can be productive and healthy, happy, you know, citizens who love nature and can be its future stewards. I mean, it's I don't want to call it a distraction, but it is a detour from the big crises I feel like we face right now in the natural resource space.
Well, actually, I kind of feel like it's a giant earthquake. I mean, talk about a detour. I feel like there's been this big chasm that's opened up, and you can't get from point A to point B anymore because there's this chasm in the middle. But I'm looking at a bunch of articles that I was reading this morning, and one of them that was heartening was that after Pruitt made his statement about how climate change is still up for grabs in terms of being proven, he received a deluge. I mean, a deluge is an understatement of angry phone calls. Are you aware? Do you know much about the switchboard problems they had at the EPA office on Friday after that statement?
Oh, absolutely. And I was one of the calls.
And so, good for you.
I said a lot during the confirmation process about how, you know, first and foremost, the administrator of the EPA has to have a fidelity to sound science, what Bill Riley, the former administrator, Republican former administrator, used to call the secular religion of the EPA being, you know, kind of a commitment to sound science. I think we need to see more of this kind of activism, because you're going to see more of these kind of statements. And my hometown, I grew up in Syracuse, New York, and the newspaper there, they ran the article about the calls. I was talking to my mom the other day, and they actually included his phone number. They included the switchboard number in the article. It's kind of, I think, a clever way to kind of encourage more more calls. So, I mean, I do think that as your fantastic listeners are thinking about ways to get involved, I mean, I do think engaging directly. I think, you know, protests and those things are great, but at the end of the day, you know, contacting your local officials, letting them know that you're disgusted, that you're paying attention, that you're keeping track. I mean, those things have an impact. I mean, I don't think most folks grow up wanting to be on the wrong side of history. And, you know, if you shut down the switchboard, there's a days in a row, and again, you're not going to win every fight, but you're setting a tone of accountability. So when those opportunities to make change are there, you've already kind of laid the foundation. So I think this stuff all matters.
I think I'll put the phone number on the website here after the show.
That's great.
Because people can still call the EPA and let them know what you think about climate change.
Yeah, we should keep calling until he says that. I mean, I wouldn't mind if he just repeated what he said during the congressional hearing.
Right.
During the Senate hearing, he said that, yes, it's the primary cause. And then, you know, 3 weeks into office, he says, no, it's not. So you have a potential perjury issue before the United States Congress, before the United States Senate, because he's, you know, contradicting something he said 3 weeks earlier and repeated in written testimony. But, I mean, that's what he actually thinks.
Actually,
that's what we have to, and I think, I mean, I appreciate the interview because it was honest.
Actually, I appreciate it more than his hearings. I mean, I felt like his hearings were kind of like Jeff Sessions' hearings, where he says, I am not a racist. Sure. prove it.
And this is the challenge, because, I mean, there's other nominees. We were pretty supportive of Ryan Zinke for Interior, but he's someone that has at least supported sound science and at least, you know, supported public lands and at least has some conservation ethic. I mean, we haven't seen any of that in Administrator Pruitt. And I mean, just the other day, I mean, he took the word science out of like the scientific office's mission. I mean, there's just these examining the climate has pretty much been scrubbed from, you know, most parts of the top level parts of the website. They're doing exactly what they said they were going to do. And I think it's going to take, you know, kind of good patriotic Americans to call them on that. Folks that want to have a brighter future for their kids and their kids after that.
Well, one other bright point that I read today is that there's actually a number of Republicans who are part of the Climate Change Caucus in the House. Mm-hmm. And I thought interesting I think there's 10 of them, they're trying to go for 40. If they got 40, then they'd be the same size as the Freedom Caucus, and then they could do the opposite of shutting down the government. they could be a viable force. What is your sense? Do you think there's a possibility that there's 40 Republicans in the House who actually might support sound climate science?
Oh, I absolutely think there are 40. I think there's actually more than that in the caucus. I think the challenge for a lot of folks right now is being strategic on the way they come out to support climate science. I mean, I'll have conversation with folks in the House and the Senate side. They think the science is, scientific consensus is there. They may disagree on the best way to address the problem. Like a lot of folks on the right in particular would rather have a market signal, which is where I am personally. I would rather have a market signal, some kind of fee or tax that would help reduce emissions and not have government have to pick, you know, different kind of regulatory approaches that are frankly just less efficient. But I think there's a friend of mine that's a senator on the Republican side said that he used the analogy of a jailbreak, that there is a critical mass that's kind of emerging, but if folks step out one at a time, they can kind of be, to use his analogy, if the individual escaping prison, they can kind of be, you know, kind of hunted down and killed, whether it's through a primary or, you know, some other form. But if a group of them all break together, that you could actually have progress. So I'm not optimistic in the very near term about, you know, some kind of climate bill being part of a, you know, tax package or something else, even though I think there's a logic to it that you can kind of intellectually get to. I just don't think the politics is quite there. But there are at least 40 members of the House that I'd say probably 70 or 80 that are committed to solutions when that moment is right to kind of have the vote. But they're not going to step out ahead of time and kind of threaten their own career. So, you know, folks can disparage that as not being sufficiently courageous. It's somewhat strategic given the politics of money right now in the Republican Party and the way the primaries are being used to kind of have this ideological purity, Trotsky analogy or something, but there's a purification that does happen when folks step out on some of these core issues.
Well, one thing that was interesting in the article that I was reading was that a lot of these Republicans that are supporting climate science were elected from districts that voted for Clinton. So there's a softness there. There's a possibility that they wouldn't be as much threatened by a far-right challenger in a primary than other potential Republicans.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, and so ideally you're starting with the folks that are, you know, kind of the folks that are really committed to science, the folks that are in safe districts, and eventually kind of building your way out. But you look in, like, northern New York, in upstate New York, you look in, you know, some of the districts in, like, eastern Pennsylvania, into New Jersey, into Florida, these places where these, you know, kind of moderate Republicans, won by a handful of points in district, maybe Secretary Clinton won by 10 or so. Again, it's not a tough vote. It is a little tough that some of them will likely face primary challenges over some of these actions. And the primary electorate tends to be more conservative, obviously, than the general electorate that they've been successful of in the fall. But we tend to have great success with folks when we're able to talk about the impacts on their district. So if I can talk to, you know, somebody in the Intermountain West about the impacts on trout streams and how warmer trout streams are screwing up the spawning seasons that are then affecting tourism, which are then, you know, kind of affecting state revenues, I mean, there's a linear path there that's much more direct than trying to convince somebody about kind of global emission rates, global temperature charts, kind of going through the more macro version of events. I mean, if I can talk to a Republican in, you know, northern Minnesota or in somewhere in the north and kind of the upper northeast about moose populations and how ticks are now killing moose because the ticks aren't dying off, so they're going through multiple breeding cycles and they're literally sucking the blood out of moose and basically starving them. And then the moose population are declining. I mean, that's a story I can sell that's entirely local, entirely based on sound science, most of which is coming from the top universities in their own districts. It's a different place to have a conversation. And so, I mean, I'm optimistic in the long term that the arc is going to go in the right direction. The challenge, we're fighting some pretty big headwinds right now.
Well, one of these congressmen who's come out very strongly against Scott Pruitt in his comments on Friday was Florida Representative Carlos Curbelo, who is concerned about, of all things in Florida, sea level rise, which is a very serious thing in Florida. And I'm imagining that especially in South Florida, which could all be underwater in maybe 50 years if we don't do anything about what we're doing, that the realities of climate change are really right in their face and might be able to kind of make them more forceful advocates for climate science and opponents of Scott Pruitt.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen... We're at a point now in our nation's kind of experience with climate change that it's not theoretical anymore. And whether you've experienced the Hurricane Sandy's and Irene's in the Northeast or some of the flooding and you know, the flooding that we saw in, like, you know, in Louisiana or in even in Maryland. Maryland had some bad flooding last year, kind of record floods. You know, we've seen droughts in the southeast and the southwest. We've had record forest fires in, you know, in western or in eastern Oregon and Washington State and into Idaho and Montana. Even going further south than that. I mean, so we've seen, you know, different impacts everywhere. And again, not everything is 100% connected to kind of climate. But when you have those cocktails, and I use, you know, forest fires as the example of hotter, you know, hotter temperatures, less kind of water in soils as a result, you know, more invasive species and different types of pine bark beetles, less government management of some of these forests, so you have more kind of fuel, and then you get the right spark, and of course we're having forest fires that are hotter, brighter, longer, you know, more intense than they were, you know, 20 years ago, eating up more and more of the Forest Service budget, but then this leaves them less money to proactive work because they're spending all the money on forest fires. I mean, that's not a liberal or conservative frame. It's just a reality on the ground. And so we can debate about, you know, kind of what proportion of the responsibility is manned carbon emissions. But we do know that that is the, you know, even when you have this conversation with folks, we knew we have to do something about it because we're losing, you know, too many communities to these kind of fires right now. And companies that are going under, tourism dollars that are being lost, wildlife habitat that's being decimated. And again, I mean, that's just similar to, and Carlos, Representative Corbello is a, you know, very thoughtful guy, but he's right in that line of fire. When that storm, you know, when the storm track comes out and the hurricane season's projected, I mean, his district's in the middle of, you know, 20%, 30% of the projected storms every year. So for him, it's not a environmental, like, nicety. It's a kind of community safety necessity for him to be on the right side of this issue. And I think we're beginning to see that in some other parts of the country as well, because what they're hearing from some of their colleagues and what they're hearing on maybe talk radio, and, you know, from some more ideological outlets on the right, does not match what they're seeing on the ground and what they're hearing from farmers or, you know, guys in forests or sportsmen that are saying, look, things are changing really quickly. We got to do something about this.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Colin O'Mara, who's president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. We're talking about Trump's war on science and how the scientists are fighting back. So in the remaining minutes, let's talk about what plans do you have, and do you know of other scientists? What are some of the strategies that you're looking at to maintain a hold on science here in this country?
Yeah. I mean, for me, the wildlife crisis is a good frame for a lot of different constituencies, because it's a way that can bring together, you know, conservative, you know, sportsman types with maybe more liberal, like Berger, Gardner, kind of wildlife watchers, as a way to kind of unify. And I think we've all heard stories about, you know, the monarch populations, you know, declining 90%, or native bee populations crashing, or, you know, bat populations struggling, or amphibians, frogs, I mean, really struggling. I mean, we've heard a lot of these stories anecdotally. We're trying to tie them together into a bigger frame so folks understand how they're all related. The systemic threats to wildlife are completely related. The only solutions are based in sound science, but really kind of show the natural sciences to be kind of the basis of decision making. And so we're going to keep trying to, you know, work across the country, work, you know, across the aisle, trying to highlight these issues, really kind of showing that it's not just important for its kind of the ethical, moral reasons we have to conserve wildlife, which I think there are many, and the importance to kids and getting kids outdoors and kind of improving their educational performance, but also incredibly important to the economy. And the outdoor economy in the U.S. is a $646 billion economy that employs 6 million people. It should be one hell of an industry association. I'd argue it's stronger than a lot of the ones that have a lot more sway in Washington and state capitals across the country. And so we're going to work to try to mobilize that conservation army and basically say, look, you know, you can't be pro-outdoors if you're anti-science. You cannot be, you know, you can't support wildlife if you don't support sound science. And there are some basic, you know, kind of litmus tests, kind of standards that I think folks should be held accountable to. So we'll be working on that through the budget. We're working with a million other partner organizations, and I can't say enough about our partners across the left and the right that care about these same things. This does not have to be partisan, and this could be a way to begin to bridge the conversation back together.
Well, another concern I have is education. And as I started in the show talking about remembering the International Geophysical Year back when I was in third grade, with Betty DeVos as head of the Department of Education, do you have any hopes of finding a backdoor way to get science education back into the schools?
We absolutely know that STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math education is the most important investment we can make right now in young people, right? That kind of early childhood education and STEM education. And the irony is that just 18 months ago in the Congress, there was overwhelming bipartisan support for massively increasing federal investment in STEM education in schools across the country. And this was bipartisan. This was led by folks like Lamar Alexander from Tennessee and Bobby Rush, a Democrat from Virginia, and Patty Murray from Washington and others. It was a massively bipartisan conversation. And one of the things that we were pushing and worked with the committee leadership on was making sure that environmental education was a big part of the STEM curriculum, and making sure that was kind of front and center as one of the best ways to learn about the natural sciences. So I still think that consensus exists. I mean, the Chamber of Commerce, who, you know, we don't agree with on in some things, was, you know, really hard pushing for more science education. All the big companies, all the Fortune 500 companies, are all pushing for more science education. So I'm still optimistic that those headwinds are pretty strong in our favor on the education side. What worries me is on the application side, on the government side, on the data side. You know, even like little things like the renewable fuel standard, not little, but the renewable fuel standard like we talked about before, right? I mean, the data is clear that we're decimating habitat, yet that data is not driving decision-making in any kind of meaningful way. Like, I worry more about the downstream, kind of the use of the science, the availability of the science, than I do about some of the upstream education investments. And I think, frankly, what worries me more is not the federal side of the science education side. It's actually more the local conversations that are, again, beginning to tilt in some parts of the country away from science towards, you know, things that I would consider a little more religious.
Well, another article that I was reading this morning was about how the electric car mandate and the and including even like hybrid plug-ins, that a lot of states, a lot of that taxing and incentives come from the state level. It also comes from the federal level, which has in the last 8 years been kind of a role model for states. But a lot of states are pulling the plug literally on electric cars, and there's a lot of concern that that could really cut down on, really sort of deplete and destroy the electric car market. So to me, that's an example of places where we need to work on a local level. How do you see ways for local action to maybe percolate up even in areas where there's not a lot of respect right now for facts, the alternative facts part of the country? But do you see a way that we can start operating on a local level, maybe starting here on the West Coast, in the Northeast, in places where there's a lot of consciousness about this, and spread it around on a local level throughout the country?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, the time for local leadership and even state level leadership is now. I mean, you know, we can use the old Brandeis and Justice Brandeis quote about, you know, states being the laboratories of innovation and democracy, and really kind of being those leading edges. And we've done it before. We've seen, you know, during all the, you know, the mayors that rose up in the last decade around, you know, the mayor's climate action, you know, pledge. When I was the Secretary of Natural Resources in Delaware for 5.5 years, I helped lead the regional greenhouse gas initiative, which was a regional cap and trade program that, you know, helped reduce emissions dramatically while at the same time our regional economy blossomed across those states. And so I think there's other examples. I mean, you live in one of the best, you know, communities in the country for thinking about innovative solutions to things like, you know, transit and transportation issues. I do think pushing the envelope a little further. Some of the statewide conversations are going to be important. I know those aren't always easy. The multi-state conversations that have broken down a couple times between California and Oregon and Washington are incredibly important. Because I do think that we need numbers. We need kind of collective power. Like, we're moving past the point where, like, the pilot projects or the small discrete projects are sufficient. We need to start to show scale. And I do think that, you know, and Portland is one of my favorite cities in the country. I do think that, you know, given the leadership on transit, on, you know, kind of smarter development, you know, in renewable energy and clean energy, I mean, there's so many things that you're all doing well that I think now is the time to be partnering with other, you know, other communities, sharing your best ideas, learning from other communities' best ideas, and having those kind of knowledge transfers happening. We're trying to work on that in a lot of places, particularly in the Midwest and in the Southeast, where you have a lot of, you know, again, a lot of, it's not partisan, a lot of Republicans that just want to save money by having more energy efficiency, or want to have, you know, slightly cleaner air by having more clean energy, or, you know, folks that want to have, you know, more wildlife habitat, or, you know, cleaner water. don't view these things as partisan. So I think there's a huge opportunity at the local level for leadership. And if there's any examples there you want, where you think we could help, we would love to assist in any way that we can.
Great. Well, we'll be in touch about that for sure. So it's always good talking with you, Colin. And let's check in again. Anything that people can look forward to in particular between April 22nd and April 29th?
No, I think you're going to hear a lot of outrage as the budget comes out on Thursday. So I just think the more folks can stay in tune and like let them know if folks have concerns, let folks know. I mean, the leadership of the Oregon delegation's obviously been very strong on a lot of these issues. Congressman Greg Walden, who's obviously from the more western part of eastern part of the state, plays an incredibly important role on some of these issues, and he's somebody that we work closely with on some conservation issues, and we've been obviously even other sides of other issues. Congressman Blumenthal has been a great leader on a lot of these issues, and so there's. Now, you have great, and obviously, of course, Senator Merkley and Senator Wyden, I can't say enough about their leadership. So I just think the more folks are engaged between now and these rallies are great, but there's more to do day to day, and we really just need all hands on deck as we're trying to set the stage for a better future.
Great. Well, thanks a whole lot for joining us, Colin.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking this morning with Colin O'Mara, who's the CEO and president of the National Wildlife Federation, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll be talking with Steve Early, who was actually on Old Mole a little earlier today, author of Refinery Town about Richmond, California. My engineer is Patsy Kulberg. Thank you, Patsy. We're going to go out with some music by Kate and Anna McGarrigle. It's my favorite song about chemistry. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening.
But somewhere in this